Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the looming possibility of another sectarian war in Iraq and the end of the Sykes-Picot borders drawn up by the British and French colonists at the end of World War I. Iraq expert and professor of modern Middle Eastern and South Asian history at the University of Michigan, Juan Cole, joins us to discuss the impending breakup of Iraq and what countries or states might be left after the next round of sectarian slaughtering is over. Then we will speak with the former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, Stephen Pfeiffer, about the likely response to Russia turning off the gas pipeline that supplies both Ukraine and other Western European countries. Ambassador Pfeiffer is the director of the Brookings Institute's Arms Control Initiative and a former special assistant to the president and senior director for Russia, Ukraine, and Eurasia on the National Security Council. We will examine the latest pressure from Russia on the new government of Petro Poroshenko and assess whether Putin is engaged in a good cop, bad cop strategy or is making it up as he goes along while the U.S. is distracted by Iraq. Then finally, we will speak with Brian Umana, a former congressional campaign manager in Charlottesville, Virginia, about his article in the Washington Post, "I'm a Democrat and I Helped the Tea Party Unseat Eric Cantor," and the possibility of a future for the left-right coalition he worked on with the insurgent Tea Party campaign of David Bratt, who beat Cantor by running an anti-Wall Street and crony capitalism campaign using immigration as a wedge issue to accuse Cantor of wanting to help corporate America import cheap labor. And joining us now is Juan Cole, who's a professor of modern Middle Eastern and South Asian history at the University of Michigan and president of the Global Americana Institute. He's the author of Sacred Space and Holy War, The Ayatollahs and Democracy in Iraq, Napoleon's Egypt, Invading the Middle East, Engaging the Muslim World, and his latest book out soon is The New Arabs, How the Millennial Generation is Changing the Middle East. He's also the author of the blog Inform Comment at JuanCole.com. Welcome to Background Briefing, Juan Cole.
Hi, Ian.
And what's your sense of how, I guess my introduction was pretty bleak, that we're about to start a new sectarian round of slaughters, apparently up to 1,700 captured Iraqi soldiers and policemen were rounded up in Saladin province and murdered. That seems to be fairly verified. Do you think that could be the beginning as Shia militias join in the fight?
Well, the people who were killed in Tikrit were police and security forces, many of them Sunni Arabs, and so they were killed for collaborating, which insurgent groups often carry out such warnings to the population not to collaborate, and it could well backfire big time, and there are lots of reports of advances by the Iraqi government troops in alliance with local Sunni Arab tribal forces in the small towns of Salahuddin province, pushing the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria back.
Well, there's only 3,000 to 5,000 fighters. I find it extraordinary that they could have taken so much territory.
Well, of course, they didn't take the territory in that sense. They provided some framework for urban revolts. I mean, essentially, Mosul and other towns in the north of Iraq have thrown off the Iraqi government. And there were large numbers of people in the streets throwing stones at the soldiers and So these are a set of urban uprisings, which have been capitalized upon and to which the radical guerrilla groups contributed. But the reports are that lots of other political parties and groups took part in these uprisings. So it shouldn't be seen as a conventional set of military conquests.
So the notion then, I mean, so many news reports indicated when refugees were crossing into the Kurdish area, the secure area in the north, almost universally everybody said they despised the Iraqi army and the police of Maliki's regime. And initial reports indicated maybe there were a lot of Baathists working with ISIL people. So what is really going on here? Is this a temporary alliance, or is this no alliance? This is just people spontaneously rising up against the government they hate that has been conveniently provided, the opportunity having been provided by ISIL.
Yes, I think that a lot of it was probably spontaneous, although there is some indication that there were meetings and that the way was prepared towards this uprising by the coalition of Sunni radicals and of nationalists, if you will, ex-Baathists and so forth, in these large Sunni Arab cities of the north. But the element of spontaneous public protest shouldn't be downplayed, and we should remember that the Sunni Arab areas of Iraq have, since 2011, joined in with the Arab Spring in many ways. They have staged the same kinds of campaigns, protests, use of internet against the Maliki government that youth in Tahrir Square did against the Mubarak government in Egypt. And these Sunni Arab protests were, as happened in Syria and Libya, brutally crushed by the Maliki government. So that there has been popular discontent and not just guerrilla discontent for some time is obvious.
So what's your sense then, Juan Cole, as the Shia militias mobilize? The U.S. apparently has sent in reinforcements. They're sending in 275 troops, mostly to reinforce the American embassy in Baghdad. But I can't imagine, Obama seems to be trying to use this situation to leverage some sense out of Maliki to come up with a political solution and be more inclusive. But he's pretty much lost the Sunnis, hasn't he, from what you're telling us?
Oh, he has lost the Sunnis a long time ago. Al-Maliki, Nouri al-Maliki, is a leader of the Dawa Islamic Party. Dawa is a word that's used kind of like we use the word mission or missionary. It's a Shiite fundamentalist party that has dreamed since 1957 or so of an Islamic Shiite state of Iraq. Its followers typically are religious. Maliki, when he visits Washington, there's been press that he wouldn't shake women's hands, and people were surprised. This is a fundamentalist Shiite government, and he was the Damascus bureau chief of the Dawa party, this revolutionary Shiite party, for 20 years in exile, conspiring against the Saddam Hussein government. He probably was involved in setting up the Hezbollah militia in southern Lebanon. And so to expect him to play nicely with the Sunnis is forlorn.
But given that the ISIL insurgents have just taken Tal Afar, where there's a big Shia community, are they likely to slaughter the Shias? You just mentioned how many of the people that they rounded up and killed into Crete were actually Sunni, and that might backfire on them. But what about Tal Afar? And presumably, what would they do with the Shias there?
Yes, I think the Shia of Tal Afar are in big danger. Actually, Tal Afar is a Turkmen city. The people there speak a form of Turkish. It was sort of half and half, as I understand it, Sunni and Shiite. But then the Sunnis of Tal Afar had strongly joined the Ba'ath Party, and they really resented the American invasion, and so they turned insurgent. And the U.S., in conjunction with Kurdish forces, invaded Tal Afar and defeated the Sunni groups there. And over time, the Sunni Turkmen were largely ethnically cleansed from Tal Afar, so it became a predominantly Shiite city. One could imagine now, you know, Sunni Turkmen showing back up and reclaiming their property, and there's liable to be violence of a sectarian sort.
So again, I'm speaking with Juan Cole, who's a professor of modern Middle Eastern and South Asian history at the University of Michigan and the president of the Global Americana Institute. He's the author of Sacred Space and Holy War, The Ayatollahs and Democracy in Iraq, Napoleon's Egypt, Invading the Middle East, Engaging the Muslim World. And his latest book out soon is The New Arabs, How the Millennial Generation is Changing the Middle East. He's also the author of the blog Inform Comment at JuanCole.com. So given that the only safe place, in effect, to be in Iraq is, I guess, if you're down in the south, around Basra, you're okay. But essentially, the safest place is the Kurdish enclave, that now that they've taken the oil cities and Mosul, they're seem to be headed for even more independence and more autonomy and more self-sufficiency. So I guess in the broader sense, this is the end of Sykes-Picot, is it?
Yes, the Sykes-Picot agreement was secretly made between the British and the French governments in 1916, looking forward to the end of the Ottoman Empire, which ruled most of the Middle East at that time, but had entered the war on the side of Germany and Austria. The British and the French, who had been protective of the Ottoman Empire or allies of it in the 19th century, decided that it must end. And then the question was, who would pick up the pieces? President Woodrow Wilson, as he started to think about coming into the war, had hoped to see peoples in the former empires, as with the Austro-Hungarian Empire, become independent nation-states. But the French and the British vision was very different. They had colonial empires, and they intended to simply add bits of the Ottoman Empire to their colonial empires. And so the French were awarded Syria, and the British were awarded much of the rest of the Arab world, including Iraq, and Jerusalem was to go to Russia. And they just divvied up the place, and the French, after the war was over, insisted on taking what was promised to them, which was Syria. And then they divided Syria to make it easier to rule and created Lebanon. And Iraq went to Britain. There was a dispute between the British and the French over the city of Mosul, which was an oil city at that time. And the French wanted to add it to Syria, and the British objected. And ultimately, the French were not in a strong position because on the ground, the British really had been the ones to take Syria away from the Ottomans. And so the French leader, Georges Clemenceau, verbally simply gave Mosul to British Prime Minister Lloyd George. So these things were done, you know, as gentlemen's agreement on the back of napkins.
With absolutely no input from the indigenous people, right?
No, exactly. The indigenous people were not consulted. Wilson wanted them to be, but they were closed out of the process. And as a result, in 1920, the Iraqis staged a massive nationwide revolt against the British, which they didn't want to be a colony.
Right, and the British used poison gas against them, against the rebels. So tell me, though, about this, just moving fast forward to the situation today. What culpability is there to the Saudis and these Gulf Emirates and for supplying and arming and funding these jihadists, these Sunni extremists? They obviously just got about $500 million that they just stole from the banks that they sacked. But hasn't there been, you know, essentially a long support for this kind of Sunni jihadism from our ally Saudi Arabia? And it's starting to look as if maybe, you know, whether or not we, in the long run and in the broader sense, we backed the wrong horse and should have supported the Shia instead of the Sunni. But now when there's rumors of working with Iran, you're beginning to wonder whether this is yet another example of Sunni kings, the perfidy of Sunni kings.
Well, you know, these things are all very murky, as it's difficult to get to the bottom of it. And I presume that that the NSA or the U.S. Department of the Treasury must have some better sense than I do of exactly the money flows here. What I can piece together from open sources suggests to me that it's not so much, you know, that King Abdullah of Saudi Arabia or the Emir of Kuwait from the Al-Sabah dynasty are themselves sending money to Al-Qaeda affiliates. I think they're rather afraid of them. But, you know, the vast oil wealth and natural gas wealth that's flowed into the Persian Gulf region, especially in the past decade when prices have been very high, has sloshed around into the hands of citizens, of people outside the royal families or the government. So there are huge business interests and billionaires who, some of whom, you know, have extremely conservative Muslim views, and some of whom admired bin Laden. And it appears to be the case that these very wealthy individuals and groups in a place like Kuwait, who are called Salafis, a kind of Sunni fundamentalism, they seem to be the ones who were sending money to a group like the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, or to the Jabhat al-Nusra, the Succor Front, and in hopes of turning Syria from being a secular socialist country towards being a fundamentalist paradise. So I think that if this is true, the U.S. has been remiss in not trying to prevent those money flows.
And on the other side, the Shia side, I'm a little bit surprised that Iran hasn't, since it's been the main beneficiary of America's intervention in Iraq and has a lot of influence over the Maliki government, they don't seem to be able to have affected him in any way. Maybe they're just as evangelical as he is in terms of their Shia zeal. But what's your understanding of why it is that this boneheaded leader has dug this huge hole, which we now, I mean, not to mention Bush, Cheney, Rice, Rumsfeld, Wolfowitz, Feith, Bremer, all of those clowns disbanding the Iraqi army, the very thing that we need now. But just in terms of Iran's influence, why have they not weighed in to give this terrible leadership a wake-up call before now it seems to be almost too late?
Yes, Ian, I think you make a very canny suggestion when you say that perhaps the Iranians weren't any better than al-Maliki in this regard. And I think we should remember that with regard to Iran's foreign policy in a place like Iraq, the Revolutionary Guards Corps has a great deal to say about these things, and especially the special forces of the Revolutionary Guards, headed by Qasem Soleimani.
The Quds Force.
And, I'm sorry?
The Quds Force.
The Quds Brigade is the Jerusalem Brigade. That's right. They're the special forces. And there are, a lot of them are hardliners, not necessarily Soleimani himself, who I think is somewhat pragmatic. But, you know, back in this height of the Iraqi civil war between the Sunnis and the Shiites, when there was ethnic cleansing of neighborhoods, the U.S. Gathered some evidence that the Revolutionary Guards were helping the Shiite militias of Baghdad to plot out this ethnic cleansing of the Sunnis and to make Baghdad a largely Shiite city, which they did. So it may well be that al-Maliki doesn't get pressured by the hardliners in Iran to be nice to the Sunnis, and they may bear part of the blame for this debacle. And I think we should remember also that the last few years, the president was Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, who was himself a populist Shiite hardliner. I think the new president, Hassan Rouhani, is a more sensible man, but of course he's come very late on the scene.
Well, Juan Cole, in the last minute then, do you think that this is the sectarian violence will continue, that there's another round of slaughtering on the horizon here?
Well, I think It's very likely that the al-Maliki government, or the central government of Iraq, which is predominantly in the hands of the Shiites and to some extent the Kurds, will find these developments unacceptable and will launch a counter struggle to retake Mosul and the north. And so I expect both the Kurdish Peshmerga and the Iraqi army, largely Shiite, and the Shiite militias to engage in counter-strikes. So I think we're, this means war.
Well, Juan Cole, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Juan Cole, who's a professor of modern Middle Eastern and South Asian history at the University of Michigan and the president of the Global Americana Institute. He's the author of Sacred Space and Holy War, The Ayatollahs and Democracy in Iraq, Napoleon's Egypt Invading the Middle East, Engaging the Muslim World, and his latest book out soon is The New Arabs, How the Millennial Generation is Changing the Middle East. He's also the author of the blog Informed Comment at juancole.com. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back talking about how Russia has turned off the gas pipeline that supplies Ukraine.
Oh yeah, yeah, oh yeah, yeah. War is not the answer. Politician and them bubonaiers thing. War is not the answer. Something over the solution, Rasta says. Yeah. War is not the answer. Tell the politician and them start drop them bomb. Yeah. War is not the answer. Something over the solution, Rasta says. Yeah. War is not the answer.
From Russia with love I fly to you, much wiser since my goodbye to you.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Stephen Pfeiffer, who's the director of the Brookings Institute's Arms Control Initiative, where he focuses on arms control, Ukraine, and Russian issues. And he served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State in the Bureau of European and Eurasian Affairs, U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine, and Special Assistant to the President and Senior Director for Russia, Ukraine, and Eurasia on the National Security. In addition to Kiev, he had postings in London, Moscow, Geneva, and Warsaw, as well as on the National Security Council. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ambassador Stephen Pfeiffer.
Thank you for having me.
And Russia has, or Gazprom has cut off the gas supplies to Ukraine, demanding back payment. My understanding is it's, that a lot of that gas goes on to Europe. Germany has a separate pipeline, but I believe a lot of Western European countries will be affected. And in addition to that, Russia's also banned the importation of Ukrainian potatoes based upon some idea that they have a parasite. So is Putin turning the screws? Is that what's going on here?
Well, I think the Russians are ratcheting up the pressure on the government of Kyiv. Now, what they've done with regards to gas is they've reduced the amount of gas that's going into the Ukrainian pipelines by the amount of gas they would normally ship to Ukraine. They're continuing to put into those pipelines the transit gas that passes through Ukraine that goes on to Europe. So far, that does not appear to be affected, and Europe gets about half the gas that it buys from Russia comes through Ukrainian pipelines.
So, but did the Ukrainians once before, when they were cut off, tap into that gas that goes to Europe?
Right. What happened back both in 2006 and 2009 was the Ukrainians tapped into the gas. Now, the situation is actually quite different now because in 2006 and 2009, the cutoffs happened in early January, the middle of winter. From Ukraine's perspective, if there's going to be a gas cutoff, now's the right time to do it. It's summer, it's warm. They don't need gas for heating, and they've got several months of gas stockpiled. So in terms of timing, this is probably the best possible time, and it gives the Ukrainian government a bit of time to figure out how they're going to play this.
Well, according to the Prime Minister, Yatsenyuk, he's saying this is not about gas. This is a general plan for the destruction of Ukraine. It began with the annexation of Crimea, they're Donbass terrorists supplying Russian weapons and sending Russian bandits into the territory of Ukraine. So hyperbole notwithstanding, does he have a case?
Well, I think if you look at what's happened going back to late February, which is when the previous president, Mr. Yanukovych, fled Kyiv, and an interim government came into office and made clear that it wanted to draw closer to Europe, you've seen the Russians apply a variety of pressure. The seizure of Crimea, blatant land grab. You've seen economic pressure. You've seen the Russians raise the price of gas. And then I think it's fairly clear that there is Russian support for the armed separatists in eastern Ukraine in the regions of Donetsk and Luhansk, where you've had this fighting over the last 2 months now. So it's very, very apparent that the Russians are doing things to try to destabilize the government in Ukraine.
So these tanks that crossed and the fact that the rebels or separatists shot down the Ilyushin jet, killing the Ukrainian soldiers, the means to do that have been supplied by Russia. So the question would be, how micromanaged are these groups? Are they, because even some of the Chechens were coming in from the warlord down there, Putin's guy. So is Putin micromanaging this, or is this just something that he tweaks? Does he make it up as he goes along, or is he playing this kind of good cop, bad cop? Because he didn't welcome the election of Petro Poroshenko, but he certainly, acknowledged it.
Yeah, no, I think there is, first of all, probably not a grand strategy here. It looks like a lot of the decisions that the Russians have taken over the last 3 or 4 months with regards to Ukraine have been on an ad hoc basis. And my guess is that when you look at the groups, the armed groups in eastern Ukraine, in Donetsk and Luhansk, you have a mix. You have some groups that are primarily local, but I think you have some groups that are organized, supported, and led by Russians. The Ukrainians claim them, and I think they're probably right on this, that there are Russian military personnel operating in eastern Ukraine. And certainly when you talk about tanks, you just don't buy the tank at your local local goods store. You get it from a military, and I think that's fairly striking evidence that the Russians are providing support.
And the Ilyushin jet, passenger jet that was shot down, killing the Ukrainian soldiers, that was fired at three Stinger-type missiles were fired at it, along with an anti-aircraft weapon. So obviously Stinger missiles are reasonably advanced equipment, and that's not something that you give out lightly, as far as I can tell.
No, I think some of the separatists, when they took over police stations, claimed that they found weapons, AK-47s, in the police stations. But as far as I know, most Ukrainian police stations do not store tanks, Grad missile launchers, or surface-to-air missiles. So there's a lot of suspicion, with good reason, that these sorts of weapons are coming across the border from Russia. And that's the sort of thing that if the Russians wanted to be part of the solution rather than part of the problem, the Russians could do a lot more to seal the border and prevent this flow of weapons and fighters and supplies that are coming across.
So again, Stephen Piper, the director of the Brookings Institute's Arms Controls Initiative, former U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine and Special Assistant to the President and Senior Director for Russia, Ukraine, and Eurasia on the National Security Council. What do you think, then, is Putin's strategy? If he's making it up as he goes along, is it because the U.S. is now distracted in Iraq that he can turn the screws a little more? I mean, cutting off the supplies or embargoing Ukrainian potatoes sounds a bit like what they did earlier with the so-called chocolate king, now the new president of Ukraine, Petro Poroshenko's chocolate, saying that it somehow wasn't properly pasteurized or whatever, even though it sells in Western Europe where they have much higher standards. So what is these are sort of, where's the sort of end game here? What do you think at the end of the day Putin wants? Does he want grab a chunk of this territory, or he just wants to continually to make life difficult for this new government?
Yeah, I think the goal is to make life difficult for the new government with the idea of trying to hold Ukraine within Moscow's sphere of influence. and preventing Ukraine or persuading the government in Kyiv not to go down the path of drawing closer to the European Union by an association agreement. And that is the association agreement which Ukraine plans to sign with the European Union in about 11 days. That document, if Ukraine implements it, and that's a big if because there's a lot of detail in that document, but if that document is implemented, Ukraine looks very, very different. And it moves probably irretrievably out of Moscow's sphere of influence. And that's what Putin is trying to fight here. So I think you have seen the pressure continue. Although so far, Mr. Poroshenko and with the support of the Ukrainian parliament have said that they intend to go forward with the European Union.
So this is really sort of, is this some kind of Pavlovian deal here where he just turns up the pressure in the hope that eventually they'll come to their senses and the pain will be sufficient that they'll change their mind? Or are they lucky to dig in and go with the European deal? So far, their military has proven spectacularly inadequate, the Ukrainian.
The Ukrainian military has had some successful operations, but certainly if you look at the last 6 or 8 weeks, their overall performance has been mixed at best. But I think Poroshenko, he's now talked about putting out a peace plan. He's talked about the possibility of a ceasefire, although that will depend in part on what the armed separatists do. So I think he's trying to find a way to reach some kind of a settlement. And the real question is, in terms of Russia, is Russia going to try to make that process easier, or is it going to try to frustrate that process? And the evidence so far suggests that the Russians don't want to see a settlement, that they want to keep things on edge in Ukraine, which is unfortunate. I mean, Mr. Poroshenko, when you look at his domestic agenda, sort of healing the divisions within Ukraine, economic reform, some political reform, some decentralization of power, he's got a huge to-do list, and the Russians are not making it any easier.
But signing this European deal, which will then move them more into the Western European orbit and away from Russian influence, how could that be a kind of Rubicon under these conditions? I mean, there'd be no evidence, for example, or no suggestions, or I can see that Putin will stop. I mean, if he really doesn't want this to happen, once it happens, he's not going to stop pressuring them, surely.
Well, I think there is a hope that if it does happen, that maybe the Russians begin to back down a little bit. We'll have to see on that score. The other question is that when the G7 leaders met in early June in Normandy, they talked about giving Russia a month, but that if Russia was not being more a part of the solution, that there could be additional Western sanctions. Now, the sanctions that have been applied to date by the United States and the European Union have been relatively modest, but they are having an economic impact. For example, according to Bloomberg, Russian companies in 2013 sold about $43 billion in foreign currency bonds. Since March of this year, they've sold zero. But what the sanctions have not yet accomplished is their primary political goal, which is to effect a change in Russian policy. So there, one question will be, is the West prepared to ratchet up those sanctions with the hope of persuading Mr. Putin and the Kremlin that it's time to back off on the pressure of Ukraine and seek some kind of a settlement?
And that's the only leverage we have, right, at this point.
The West has been pretty clear that it's not going to use military force. It's not going to deploy American or NATO troops into Ukraine to defend Ukraine. So right. I think the conclusion both in Washington and in Brussels is that the best tools right now are probably economic.
Well, the former are completely unrealistic, aren't they? I mean, you can't go to war on Russia's border. I mean, not with a nuclear power. So I mean, it would seem that the options are limited. But are they particularly likely to work? If I'm just trying to get a handle here, I guess, on how much Putin really feels strongly about this idea that somehow his sphere of influence is being encroached upon, and that this is a line that he's drawn, and he's going to, hunker down.
Yeah, well, I think there is a possible deal for the Russians if the Russians are prepared to deal. President Poroshenko has said he's not interested in bringing Ukraine closer to NATO, And that is, I think, even for simply for domestic reasons, that would be hugely controversial within Ukraine. So one could see some kind of an arrangement where they perhaps address the NATO question, where there's some assurances to the Russians that Ukraine is not going to turn up in the membership queue for NATO, but that then Ukraine is allowed to go ahead without being harassed by Russia and do its association agreement with the European Union, recognizing that the European Union is a very different institution from NATO. Now, the question is, at the end of the day, would the Russians be prepared to accept that? So far, it doesn't appear that they are. With regard to sanctions, it seems to me that the question here is, and this goes back, Russians have talked about for 10 or 11 years now this implicit social compact that Mr. Putin has with the Russian people, in which he basically says, you're not going to have much political power, but in return, I'm going to give you economic stability, growth, and rising living standards. And he delivered spectacularly on that from 2000 to 2008. Last year, when Russian economists were talking about growth for the Russian economy of maybe 2% in 2014, they were asking, is that enough for Mr. Putin to hold up his side of the bargain? Well, now people are projecting that the Russian economy will stagnate this year, zero growth, and perhaps may even go into recession. So the question is, and we don't know the answer, does that get Mr. Putin begin to change his calculation because he begins to worry that economics are going to cause him to lose some of his approval ratings with the population.
So we don't really know whether how pragmatic Putin is, whether he really believes the kind of stuff he says about NATO and the West, or whether he is, at the end of the day, pragmatic. I mean, he's obviously riding high in the polls. So far, it's worked out well for him domestically. But, you know, this situation can't continue indefinitely, can it?
No, I think that's right. But I think, like many people, he's probably a mixture of both. And the question is, can the West create the combination of circumstances, which would be, again, sanctions that inflict increasing economic pain that Mr. Putin decides he would prefer to avoid? And then if you have the Ukrainians lay out a settlement offer that appears to address at least some of the Russian concerns, does that provide then the basis for a settlement? And Mr. Poroshenko has said things like, you know, he's prepared to decentralize authority, to push some political power out to the regions. He's prepared to give some status to the Russian language. So he's put some things on the table that should be of interest to the Russians and should be of interest to the population in eastern Ukraine. But again, I think the big question mark that everybody can't yet resolve is, at the end of the day, are the Russians prepared to accept any kind of a compromise that still allows Ukraine to draw closer to the European Union?
Well, Ambassador Stephen Pfeiffer, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Stephen Pfeiffer, who's the director of the Brookings Institute's Arms Control Initiative, where he focuses on arms control, Ukraine, and Russian issues. He served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State in the Bureau of European and Eurasian Affairs, U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine, and Special Assistant to the President and Senior Director for Russia, Ukraine, and Eurasia on the National Security Council. In addition to Kiev, he had postings in London, Moscow, Geneva, and Warsaw, as well as on the National Security Council. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking with a Democratic political operative who worked and who helped the Tea Party campaign to unseat Eric Cantor. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Brian Umana, who is a writer, filmmaker, and a former congressional campaign manager based in Charlottesville, Virginia. He was a co-founder of SU3 Media Group and has an article at the Washington Post, "I'm a Democrat and I helped the Tea Party unseat Eric Cantor." Welcome to Background Briefing, Brian Yumana.
Hi, Ian. Thank you for having me.
And the idea that you were a part of a kind of left-right coalition, was it a sort of stealth coalition that you worked with the campaign of the insurgent Tea Party candidate Dave Bratt, who was responsible for the surprise upset victory over the second most powerful Republican in the House of Representatives?
Right. Well, I would characterize it more by saying that I had longstanding relationships with other people who were helping him and had known me for several years because we both had campaigned against Cantor in the past as staffers for other candidates in prior election cycles, coming at Cantor from different directions. I was managing the campaign of a Democratic Party nominee, and in the last couple elections, Cantor has had third-party challengers and one 30-party challenger who became a Republican, a challenger for the Republican nominee 2 years ago, but did not really raise enough money to be a credible threat to Cantor at the time. And also, I think there is something to the fact that Bratt was a more credentialed candidate this year, and that some of the people who were needed to organize on the Tea Party side against Cantor this year were really more preoccupied 2 years ago with staying a little bit more in line in the hope that perhaps they could elect Mitt Romney rather than Barack Obama in the presidential election at that point. And I'm quite glad that they failed in those efforts.
So the fact, though, that Dave Bratt ran a campaign that some analysts, I spoke to the chair of the political science department at the University of Richmond the other day, and he was saying that in many ways Bratt sounded like a Occupy candidate as opposed to a Tea Party candidate, because he ran against Cantor using the immigration issue as a wedge issue to castigate Cantor for wanting to be a shill for corporate America to allow in cheap labor. He apparently went after Cantor on the Stock Act, the Insider Trading Act for Congress people that Cantor watered down, portrayed him as a champion of crony capitalism and of Wall Street. I guess Cantor's wife, of course, works on Wall Street. Is that a correct description? Is that the campaign that you both observed and were involved in?
Well, I was very separate from the messaging side of the Bratt campaign, and I began following it midway through that campaign and really was staying in touch with people whom I already knew and had, years before shared some data with them and some analysis with them of where I thought Cantor's vulnerabilities were, because we had at that time a better organized and more resourceful campaign than they did, and we just were able to use data science more effectively and so on. I think some of what that political scientist said sounds accurate, and maybe some of it not so much. I mean, the Occupy thing, what I've heard from people is that Bratt is well-educated but is in some ways right of Cantor. I don't know what his true views are, really, and the extent to which he was pandering to these people. I know more about the political mechanics of how the voters were turned out, how the Tea Party took over the levers of power within this part of the Virginia Republican Party, which is quite remarkable, and they actually managed to reach out to tens of thousands of people whom they needed to reach out to. I think that, you know, in invoking the Occupy movement, that sounds a little bit bizarre to me, although sometimes there is always a little bit of convergence with certain pieces of rhetoric from the far left and the far right, in the sense that they all feel like outsiders. And there certainly is a strong sense in the district that Cantor was not particularly interested in helping his constituents unless they could be donors who would write the maximum checks to them. He was not particularly interested whatsoever in ever debating other opponents, or even more remarkably, because you could argue that the debate stance was good strategy. More remarkably, he would refuse to have town hall meetings with his constituents and supporters to help them organize against Obamacare or voice their complaints or feel like the majority leader, who is ostensibly their own representative in Congress, regardless of their party. But certainly the right-wingers felt like they should have had a strong connection to him. They really didn't, because he kept himself unavailable. And, you know, Washington, D.C. is a two-hour drive from his district. So I think that increasingly irritated a lot of them. And I think that what the political scientist told you, I obviously was not part of that conversation, but I think that there was an increasingly widespread perception that that Cantor was very much about using money to concentrate power within a very small group of people, which irritated a number of Democrats, but almost even more so the Tea Partiers. And the Tea Partiers had extremely strong sentiment against the bailouts. And some of the bailouts I sympathized with Cantor more on because you know, the economic situation was really disastrous at certain points, and I think there were moments when he was trying to be a pragmatist, but then there also were times that that he didn't recuse himself on votes on bailouts that actually, you know, provided major help to banks that his family had a major financial interest in and things like that. I mean, either through his wife's career or through his, you know, major donors, or through a variety of other conflicts of interest, potentially.
Again, I'm speaking with Brian Umana, who is a writer, filmmaker, and a former congressional campaign manager based in Charlottesville, Virginia. He was a co-founder of SU3 Media Group and has an article at the Washington Post. I'm a Democrat, and I helped the Tea Party unseat Eric Cantor. So the fact that David Bratt, the Tea Party candidate, did campaign against Eric Cantor on the Stock Act, which Cantor watered down, on his connections to Wall Street, I think that's all fairly unassailable. And immigration as a wedge issue, my understanding is that he did campaign on the idea that Cantor is a shill for corporate America.
I think that's all correct. Yes.
Right. So what is the area then of interest, apart from the technical stuff, where you provided the Tea Party with some of the data similar to the advanced ground game that the Democrats had in Ohio in the last presidential election that caught the Republicans by surprise, in terms of ideology, a left-right connection? Because, for example, it's always been clear for the longest time that environmentalists on the left and national security hawks on the right share a common interest in energy independence and green energy. Is there anything to be learned from your experience that would indicate there are areas of agreements that people on the left and people on the right can work together on?
Well, so the areas of policy agreement I really see as separate from the issue of political mechanics. I think that you named a number of them. Now, I think that Democrats do not sympathize with these far-right immigration views, and I think that Cantor took the big business perspective and the, you know, sort of George W. Bush perspective that immigration reform made some sense because it helps big business in the U.S., and, you know, Democrats tend to have a more liberal view about you know, not pursuing immigrants in the same type of way that with the same vigor and sort of border walls and these types of extreme measures that the Tea Party and Minutemen and these more extreme factions tend to support. But Bratt got a lot of traction from that issue because that is really what brought the support of Ann Coulter and Laura Ingraham to him, who are, of course, celebrity conservative talk hosts, and wrote columns in his favor and helped legitimize him in terms of his own fundraising operation, among other things.
So in terms, though, of your personal experience working with the operatives, with the Dave Brat campaign, what was their attitude to working with a Democrat?
Well, the subtitle of my piece in the Washington Post was the enemy of my enemy is my frenemy. And really, the process was that starting in 2010, there was a lot of caginess, but we got to know one another and have some level of respect for one another as people, if not necessarily for most of the political views the other side had, because there were increasing levels of trust built up during the campaign when we weren't sharing information, but rather, having calls returned by the other side to ask specific questions and coordinate debates among our own candidates that Cantor refused to participate in, and things like that. And then afterwards, we were comfortable enough with one another to sit down and begin to share our experiences of running against Cantor and where we thought Cantor was vulnerable. And, you know, really what I saw at that time is that the Tea Partiers had a remarkable number of supporters in the district, and there were a remarkable number of people whom in our own polling and our own field outreach through phone calls and door knocks to try to get people to vote. We would stumble across a number of, obviously we were trying to motivate our own base foremost, but we would call undecideds and others about whom there was comparatively less data, and we would stumble across people who would tell us that they were very conservative, but that they disliked Cantor and they never would vote for a Democrat. And to me at the time, those people, we would come across the data for tens of thousands of people responding to survey questions for us and so on. And so hundreds of Tea Partiers and others, and we were just a lot more sophisticated about pulling lists and targeting voters than the Tea Partiers were. At the time, we didn't see the Tea Partiers as our opposition at all. Personally, to me, we saw them particularly these people who weren't engaged in activism, but were more likely to say, you know, I'm conservative, but I don't like Cantor, but I'll never vote for a Democrat. We didn't particularly care if they voted. We didn't want to, you know, discourage them to vote or something. We knew we weren't going to win their vote, so we just found them kind of interesting from a political perspective, a cultural perspective, and an anthropological perspective, really. After the election, it became clear that the Tea Partiers weren't reaching people in that same type of way. They were kind of going to public meetings. They were engaging with activists who were really willing to devote tons of time to politics and make it their huge hobby, rather than people who might vote for them and just go out in a primary or a general election campaign and vote in their direction. Were those people actually to have contact with a campaign from them and be asked to vote and become familiar with their candidate? And we really felt that some of these Tea Partiers, or most of them in 2010, had approximately the data sophistication of a campaign from the 1950s. But, they had a number of other things going for them. And so it seemed, and we agreed with them that Cantor was in many ways, more disingenuous than either of the other candidates and less respectful of the constituents in the district. And that's certainly not how I feel about all Republicans, but I had been annoyed. I got involved because I'd been annoyed with some of the ways that Cantor had treated President Obama and with his attitude that, you know, the almighty dollar is really what should rule American politics. And it just was, he doesn't seem to have a vision of democracy that I share. And a lot of people, that really was the biggest thing that brought left and right together in the district.
So, Brian Umana, given that we've got a Democrat running against Bratt in November, who's actually a colleague of his from the same college, is it possible that Cantor and other Republican sore losers will run somebody, will run a third party? Because that's the only way the Democrat will win, right? I mean, Bratt's pretty much a shoo-in, isn't he, in this conservative district?
I don't know about that, because Bratt is a, you know, he certainly is the favorite at this point. I understand that, I believe it was today that Cantor endorsed Bratt. And I imagine the reason that Cantor did that is out of concern for his own political future. Generally, participants in a major party primary sign a pledge that they will, that if they lose the primary, they will not run as a third party or write-in candidate against the party's nominee. And Cantor might have actually been in a position to buck the establishment and get himself on the ballot, but it really would hurt his standing with both the local Republicans for the future and the national Republicans to some extent. So I think he got the advice that he had. I'm speculating he received advice that he really had to endorse Bratt, swallow that bitter pill, and step aside for the time being. So anyhow, that's my assessment. I think it should be of concern to many people that the Tea Party managed to do this in part by taking over institutional levers of power within the district in a way that takes more than one election, that wasn't just a result of Dave Bratt. They had to, over a number of years, run people for local party positions and, you know, really manage to have people in those positions so that they couldn't create primary rules that would weigh heavily in Cantor's favor. And it's really remarkable that people, that Tea Partiers like that, now have so much influence within the Republican Party and have managed to take over, you know, some parts of it. I find that that's somewhat alarming just based on their views, but it certainly is an interesting time in American politics.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us, Brian Umana.
Thank you very much, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Brian Umana, who's a writer, filmmaker, and a former congressional campaign manager based in Charlottesville, Virginia. He was a co-founder of SU3 Media Group and has an article at the Washington Post. I'm a Democrat, and I helped the Tea Party unseat Eric Cantor. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.